The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. I'm pleased to introduce our guests. Paul Alexander's best-selling and acclaimed biographies include portraits of James Dean, Sylvia Plath, John McCain, and J.D. Salinger, the last of which served as the basis of a documentary that appeared on HBO, PBS, and Netflix. He is also the author of several stage plays and screenplays. A writing teacher at Hunter College in New York City, he holds memberships at the Pan American Center, the Dramatists Guild, and the Academy of American Poets. In Bitter Crop, the first new biography of Billie Holiday in more than 20 years, Alexander presents a transcendentally soaring look at the legendary jazz singer's last year of life that a Boston Globe review calls cinematic in structure. He will be joined in conversation this evening by longtime library friend and award-winning journalist and broadcaster, Tracy Matisak. Please welcome our guests.
Tuesday, we are delighted that you are with us, and we are delighted to have Paul Alexander with us to talk about Billie Holiday this evening. So why don't we jump in? We do want to let you know that we have some time toward the end for your questions for Paul. So we'll budget some time for that. So if you think of a question, just hold that thought and we'll get through as many as we can. But all of that said, Paul, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you. It's great to be here, particularly with you and your connection to the jazz world. Shall we tell them?
Sure. Why don't you do the honors?
Well, let me interview you. Tell everyone here, I'm a journalist, who your father was.
So I was so excited for the opportunity to interview Paul because my father was a jazz pianist who happened to accompany Billie Holiday on her Lady Sings the Blues album in 1956. So when I heard about the opportunity to have this conversation with Paul, I just jumped at the chance because I've always been a Billie Holiday fan, and because of the family connection, it was just extra special. So this is wonderful.
Well, that's one of her great records, too. You know, if you look at the listing on there, song after song after song,
yes,
is, you know, she's associated with. Plus, they re-recorded Strange Fruit for that record. Yeah. You know, she had recorded it originally in 1939 for Commodore Records, mm-hmm, but they re-recorded it for that record. And, you know, the title track is famous. Good Morning Heartache is on that record.
Yeah.
I mean, it just,
the big hits.
It's a terrific record, and your father played on it. And he also played on perhaps the greatest jazz recording ever made, which was Kind of Blue.
Mm-hmm.
He plays on Freddie Freeloader, as right, you well know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, so look for the name Wynton Kelly. When you listen to Lady Sings the Blues next time, you'll see, I guess his name will be in the liner notes. So,
mm-hmm,
so there it is.
So you know from which you ask questions, is my point to all this.
Well, congratulations on the book. It has been receiving rave reviews, and I can tell you, having read it, that it is chock full of information, and I learned so much about Billie Holiday's life. And before we get into the book, Paul, I want to talk a little bit about the process of writing the book, and first of all, the significance of the title, which is Bitter Crop.
Well, as I mentioned, she recorded Strange Fruit in 39. Her record label at the time was Columbia Records, and they wouldn't record the record because, mm-hmm, of its subject matter. If you don't know Strange Fruit, it's an anti-lynching, mm-hmm, song written by Abel Maripol, using the pseudonym Lewis Allen. And it became one of those records, one of those songs that Billie just became extremely possessive of, to the point where she started telling everyone she wrote the music when she didn't. But she had a habit of exaggerating stories about her life, embellishing stories. I find it endearing that she does this, but as a biographer, part of the problem that you have is sorting out which is true and which isn't. So she became very possessive of this song, and it ended up defining her life in many ways. And when I thought about And she wanted to call her own autobiography, which was ultimately called Lady Sings the Blues, she wanted to call it Bitter Crop. Mm-hmm. It's the last two words of Strange Fruit. And for her, and the final line ends with Bitter Crop. And for her, that song, she's so identified with that song and the hardships that she had to endure because of it, because of the harassment that she went through, but also the message she felt that she was conveying to the audience that would make a difference at the time on racial issues that were so vital to her. Yeah. And so I was amazed that my editor at Knopf let me keep the title Bitter Crop, because they usually come in and want to change your titles. But they didn't, and they let me keep the subtitle too, which is the heartache and triumph of her final year. I wanted to focus on the final year so you could really get to a deep dive. You can go into the rooms with her, and that's what the readers so far seem to be responding to, that you feel like you're in the same room with Billy.
You do indeed, and I have a couple of questions to ask you about that. One is, you know, as Andy mentioned, you've written about people like Sylvia Plath, John McCain, J.D. Salinger, James Dean. How did you come to Billie Holiday, and what was it that made you want to write about her?
Probably her music more than anything else. I can't remember when I wasn't listening to Billie Holiday records. You know, just sort of, she was one of those ever-present. And I just began to identify more and more with the type of music that she did and the message that she was trying to convey to the audience. And about, it was right before the pandemic, I was going to do a project on her in the theater. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, everything shut down because of the pandemic. And my agent said, well, why don't you write a book about her? So I was able then to do a really, you know, focused research period on her during the pandemic. And that's when I think I interviewed 100 people for the book and was able to get whatever research I needed from libraries that supplied it as it could. So by the end of the, you know, when we were all locked away, I had the material that I needed to write the book with, and then sort of it came after that.
So you mentioned the subtitle, which is The Heartache.
So to answer your question, The Love of Her Music.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Which I think we all share. Can you all hear me okay? Okay. So as you mentioned, the subtitle is The Heartache and Triumph of Billie Holiday's Last Year. And, you know, I think, Paul, she has been viewed for so long by so many as a tragic figure. But as I read your book, I came to see that she did not see her life in that
not
way
at all. No.
She saw her life as a triumph, and what came across to me was her overwhelming will to survive. Can you talk about her life as triumph? You know, because that's not how a lot of us have seen Billie Holiday.
No, and that's why I wanted both words in the subtitle, because we all know the heartache. They've made movies about it. You know, most of those movies are incredibly inaccurate. And they also portray her as a victim, as a failure. You know, it's a really negative portrait, all these shots of her, you know, having drug withdrawals and everything. And that was a part of her life, you know, just like it is with many entertainment figures, you know, Keith Richards, you think of, you know. So I wanted to focus on the triumphant part of her life, because in that final year, while she was dealing with all this that was always going on, she recorded Lady in Satin, which is one of the great jazz records ever recorded. And it's, you know, I think it's her masterpiece, that record. So when you focus only on the dark side and the, you know, substance abuse, then somehow you the picture isn't complete unless you look at all the triumphs as well. You know, she was constantly appearing before audiences, even in the final year, even as she was getting sicker.
Yeah.
She was still recording. After Lady in Satin, she recorded yet another record, which wasn't as good, but it was still a decent enough record. Mm-hmm. So she was continuing to be productive. She did a TV show in London 3 or 4 months before she died, which is still on YouTube. I mean, when you Google Strange Fruit, that's the performance that comes up. So I wanted an emphasis on the fact that she didn't view herself as a failure. She viewed herself as a as a success. Yeah. She thought, look what I achieved. You know, I come poor background from Baltimore, comes up through Harlem as a teenager, and she becomes one of the important figures in the entertainment figure at in the entertainment industry at that time. How is that not a triumph?
Well, and she had such an incredibly rough childhood. I knew nothing about that until I read your book. I did not know that she was born here in
Philadelphia.
She's actually
from Philadelphia. She was not born in Baltimore, although for her whole life she told everybody she was born in Baltimore. Well, her family had told her that she was born in Baltimore. She thought she was born in Baltimore, but in 1954, when she went to do her first European tour, she had to get her passport. So when she got the passport from the government, she learned for the first time that she was born in Philadelphia. That was 1954. So, but still, for the next 5 years, she continued to tell everyone that she was born in Baltimore. And in her autobiography in 1956, she said she was born in Baltimore.
Wow.
But she's really from Philadelphia.
Yeah. So, and she had such a rough childhood. She did, of course, as a very young child, she moved to Baltimore. And as you write, in her childhood, she spent time both in a Catholic reform school and in neighborhood brothels.
Yes, both.
Tell us about that.
It's the heartache and the triumph.
Yeah.
You know, because you would think the brothels would be a very negative place for her to be, but she didn't see it that way. The madams who ran these two particular houses that she was at most were these elegant, well-dressed women with evening gowns and furs. And that became the model that she wanted to base her look on, which ultimately she did, you know. Because when you see her now, you see her in the evening gowns with the beautifully done hair, which she did herself, the makeup, which she did herself.
Yeah.
All of that she created herself, and she got it from those brothels.
And why was she there? I mean, as a young child, why was she there?
Because her mother was gone most of the time, and her father was never really in her life at all. Her mother was she was doing a extended job. At the time they called it domestic help. Mm-hmm. So she was either doing something in Philadelphia. She did a period of time in New York on Long Island where she basically just lived with the family and worked for them.
Yeah.
And then Billy was kept by family members in Baltimore. And then because of the lack of supervision, she sort of just drifted to wherever she felt comfortable, and she felt comfortable in the bordellos, in part because they were playing jazz, they were playing Bessie Smith, and they were playing Louis Armstrong, and that's where she heard jazz for the first time. That's where she first was, you know, introduced to what it is that she wanted to do, and that was seeing jazz.
And at a certain point, she leaves Baltimore. She comes to New York. She and her mom move to Harlem. And at some point, you know, she begins singing in this club and that club. She begins to generate some notoriety. Eventually, she finds herself singing with Count Basie's orchestra. Mm-hmm. And not long after that, Artie Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Which was really interesting.
That's
because...
That's really important because she was the first African-American woman to sing with an all-white orchestra.
And so, in that time, Paul...
Oh, in 1938, 39, it was just, you know, it literally made the news in the entertainment press that a black woman was going to be opening or playing with a white band, and particularly in venues that were often mostly white.
Yeah, because these are the Jim Crow years.
Yes, and you would think that the South would be the worst place, but actually she had a very difficult time in Boston, and in... She finally left Artie Shaw because in New York she was playing the Lincoln Hotel and they wouldn't let her come in through the front door. She had to go up the service elevator. They wouldn't let her drink at the bar. She had to go across the street to another bar. And then they wouldn't let her appear on a radio show. They were broadcasting from there for the Artie Shaw band. And that was the breaking point. That, you know, they'd let Helen Forrest, who was white, sing on the radio, but they wouldn't let Billie Holiday sing because she was black.
Yeah. And so that
was the bridge too far.
And those were the kinds of experiences that made a song like Strange Fruit have such an appeal for her. I mean, you talked about that a moment ago, about how it was really an anti-lynching protest song.
Right.
And she began to include it in her performances
all the time
in the late 30s. And that's what caught the attention of the FBI.
Yes. In 1939, Abel Maripol, who wrote the song, brought it to Barney Josephson, who was the owner of Cafe Society down in Greenwich Village in the city, in New York City. And he says, you know, I've got this song. They knew each other through political circles. They were all connected through the Communist Party at the time, which we think of now in a particular way. Back in the day, if you were connected to the Communist Party, part of the reason could be because they were so progressive on racial issues. They were one of the early proponents of racial equality in the country. So a lot of politically black entertainers affiliated themselves with it for that. So Abel Maripol brings the song to Barney Josephson, who says, you know, here, Billy, you want to sing this. And it was one of those, there were lots of misreporting around this. I mean, people would say, oh, she didn't understand the song. But really, she doesn't understand racial problems in 1939?
Right.
Come on, of course she understood the song. Plus, her friend Lester Young had almost been lynched when he was 14, you know? So so she associated herself with that song. She started singing into Cafe Society. Every night she would end the set with that song. You couldn't do an encore because you just can't follow that song.
It was so intense, and the imagery was so graphic, right?
Right, because the way they would stage it is they would do a pin spot on Billy, so all you saw was her face. And half the time she was crying by the end of the song. So it was a really emotional experience for the audience. And of course she wanted to record it. And when she went down to Columbia Records, where she was extremely popular, they said no because of the song's content. And so she took it over to Milt Gabler at Commodore Record, who happens to be Billy Crystal's uncle, believe it or not.
Who knew?
And he said, sure, Billy, because he knew her. You know, sure, Billy, we'll record it. Go get a 4-song release from Columbia, and we'll record it. So they did. The flip side was Fine and Mellow, which Billy wrote herself. And so when the record came out, it was a huge, even it got no radio play for the first 6 months. Nobody would play it on the radio. It still, by the end of its first year of release, it sold 1 million copies. It had to be through word of mouth because nobody would play it on the radio.
Yeah.
And so because she became a target at that time, then the government sort of harassed her for the next 20 years in some form or another. You know, they've got all these conspiracy theories now. I wouldn't say it was that organized. We're dealing with the government here. They're not that organized. But they're effective. And so... You had the FBI looking at her. You had the FBN, Federal Bureau of Narcotics, looking at her. And the local police departments, particularly this one here in Philadelphia, arrested her twice.
Yeah.
New York arrested her on her deathbed. Yeah. San Francisco Police Department arrested her at the urging of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. All of that happened because she had made herself a target with Strange. And because... which the head guy out at San Francisco was very clear about, because she was a successful black woman at the time, and that was a threat to them.
And it became an obsession with Harry, is it Anslinger? Is that
Anslinger.
How you say the name from the FBI, that he, as you wrote, really sort of relished
going after
black artists in particular.
And not just Billy, but Sonny Rollins. You know, there's a whole long list of them.
Yeah, and you talked about how he kind of wanted to put her in her place.
He did. He felt that she had... she was flaunting her gowns and her furs and her cars and her jewelry.
Yeah.
And she was just the big lady everywhere she went, was the way he phrased it.
Yeah.
So she had to be, you know, as Annie Ross said, she had to be knocked down a notch or two.
Mm. So while we're talking about Strange Fruit, I would love if you would read a short passage from the book where you write about how the song kind of came to be, and then we'll talk about a few other things after that.
It was ironic that three white Jewish men with leftist political leanings, Barney Josephson, Abel Maripol, and Milt Gabler, presented Billy with a chance to record what music producer Amin Erdogan later called, quote, a declaration of war, the beginning of the civil rights movement. But she felt supportive of their politics. She was also comfortable with Jewish people. After all, her manager, Joe Glazer, was Jewish, and her mentor, Louis Armstrong, was partially raised by a Jewish family who spoke spoke fluent Yiddish and wore a Star of David around his neck for most of his adulthood. So Billy seized the moment and embraced Strange Fruit because she believed it could contribute to the national discussion raging about race in general and lynching in particular. The press coverage the song received proved she was right. Then there was the fact that the song began to post noteworthy record sales, which it was able to do without any airplay because radio stations deemed it too controversial to broadcast. In fact, it was November before the first radio station aired the song when, according to the New York Daily News, WNEW has given its consent to the airing of the brittle song by Billie Holiday during her Cafe Society programs, heard nightly. Ultimately, Strange Fruit became Billie's best-selling record. It sold 10,000 copies in the first week of its release, and after 3 months, it reached number 16 on the popular music charts. And as she had hoped, it stood as her indefatigable statement about racism at a time when too many people were suffering and too few voices were speaking out. Quote, "It was meant to be an attack song," Abel's son, Robert Maripol, says. When Abel said he hated lynching and the people who perpetrated it, he meant it. The song was intended to be an attack. It was extremely successful. His brother, Michael Maripol, adds, and Billie Holiday, her version is what made the song famous.
Indeed, thank you. There were, of course, during this time, men in her life who were attracted to her fame, her talent, her money, but were also intimidated by her and afraid of living in her shadow. And so there's this series of men that you write about. I'm thinking about Jimmy Monroe, her first husband.
Yes.
Introduced her to hard drugs, kind of started her on the road to the addictions that then plagued her for the rest of her life. Another was brutally violent. Some had other women and families. There was so much dysfunction, and it seems that in the end, most of them left her worse than they found her.
Right. Her last song that she wrote was called Left Alone, which she wrote with Mal Waldron, her pianist, in the last 2 years of her life. And she wanted to write a song that she said was her autobiography. That was her autobiography, that she was always left alone.
Yeah.
And it was all through, from Jimmy Monroe to John Levy to Louis McKay to John Simmons. It was one after another. And they were all, none of them was faithful as far as I can tell. They were almost all abusive. They stole her money. Oh, Joe Guy is in there too. He was the one that became her heroin supplier in the mid-40s. Someone else had introduced her to heroin, but he was the heroin supplier. And it was that addiction that made her such a target to the government that they could arrest her and ended up throwing her in prison for almost a year. And she gave them that opportunity. She knew that it was a mistake, but you deal with substance abuse in the best way that you can. Mm-hmm. And after that period in the 40s, she would dabble with hard drugs. But what killed her was the drinking, because she would drink gin in order to, as she called it, kill the hunger for drugs. Mm-hmm. So to kill the drug hunger, she would drink gin, and she died of cirrhosis of the liver.
Yeah.
That's what killed her.
That was what ultimately killed her. You mentioned Louis McKay, who was her.
And the men didn't help. The men were a large part, and they stole all of her money.
Yeah.
On multiple occasions.
Yeah. Which brings me to Louis McKay, who many of us will remember the Billy Dee Williams character in Lady Sings the Blues, where he was something of a savior.
Yeah,
we'll
come back on Thursday night. You can talk to him.
In fact, he will be here on Saturday, so y'all come back for Billy Dee Williams because we're going to talk about that. But he. Completely different portrayal than the real Louis McKay.
Well, what happened was Billy died without a will, and she was still married to Louis McKay, even though they'd been separated for over a year. He had beaten her up on Memorial Day weekend in 1958, And I mean, literally left her bloodied, and she had to run to her lawyer to sort of get away from him. But that was the final fight. He moved out and moved to California. And he was gone for all that time. But when she got sick in the summer of 59, there he is back again. She hadn't divorced him, and she hadn't written a will. So when she died in July, he inherited everything, including the copyright to Lady Sings the Blues. So when Berry Gordy wanted to make that book into a movie for Diana Ross, he had to cut a deal with Lewis McKay, who had script approval. Yeah. So it was as if Lewis McKay wrote that script. Yeah. So here this man, he had systematically abused her. I mean, really violent. He would kick her dog. Who kicks a dog? Right. You know, it's a little tiny, it's Pepe. Who would kick Pepe?
Yeah.
Stole all of her money, which is why she was having to work as hard as she was during the last year of her life. And yet he ends up with the estate. Yeah. And he was the one that dictated how that character would be portrayed yeah. in the movie that Billy Dee Williams. Now, Billy Dee Williams had nothing to do with any of this. So don't blame him. He's a wonderful actor, yes. and he needed a job. And there, you know, he took it. And he was great in the movie. Yeah. It just, that's not Lewis McKay. Yeah. That's actually Billy Dee Williams pretending to be somebody else.
Yeah. There were women in Billie Holiday's yes. life as well. And you write about how it seems that the relationships that she had with women, Tallulah Bankhead, the famous yep. actress, being one of them, there was such a contrast because those relationships were the warm, nurturing kinds of relationships where she was able to get something from those relationships that she just could not get from her relationships with
Absolutely.
Men.
Absolutely. And I think I make at some point in the book, I make the observation that, you know, if she had been able to have the female affairs and just not deal with the men altogether, her life would have been completely different, you know. Her first, there were lots of girls along the way, you know, because she was in the touring bands, and, you know, the Count Basie people knew that she was running off with girls all the time. In fact, Count Basie's nickname for her was William, which was ironic because that's his real name. That was his real name. So it was known, you know, that she, you know, had this interest in girls while they were touring. But the first really serious affair was with Louise Crane. Mm-hmm. While she was performing at Cafe Society, Louise Crane would come down and see her often. If you don't know who Louise Crane was, you do know who she is because her family provides the paper to make
the Crane
money.
Paper. Yeah.
So we all have Crane paper in our wallets and pockets right now because they still supply the paper yeah. to the government. Mm-hmm. So this is Louise Crane. You can imagine how wealthy she was, living on Park Avenue, 18-room apartment. And she was just infatuated with Billy. She happened to be in a relationship at the time with the poet Elizabeth Bishop. but it was an open relationship. And the next mm-hmm. thing you knew, she and Billy were involved. And they were involved for a couple of years. They were broken up by John Hammond, the record producer, who was actually a cousin of Louise Crane, and a Vanderbilt, who's a member of the Vanderbilt mm-hmm. family. Because once he figured out that Louise was involved with Billy, that just in terms of the way he had been brought up socially, that yeah. was not something he was going to accept. So he went to the family and basically blew the whistle, and mm-hmm. that was the end of that affair.
Yeah. One of the most.
And then there was Tallulah. That went on for quite a while, though. Yeah. And they had known each other socially, you know, because Billy would see her in shows and she would come to see Billy. But it was really after Billy got out of prison in the mid-40s that the actual affair started. And it went on until the early 50s. Yeah. It was a long-term thing yeah. That she had with Tallulah while she was also at the same time involved with John Levy. Mm. She called him a husband, even though they were never married.
You mentioned the prison time that she did, and there was an incredibly consequential night in her life here in Philadelphia. And as you write about, you said that there were three prevailing elements in her life that all sort of collided on this night
time.
In Philadelphia. The addiction, the political views, because she had expressed support for communism because of their, resistance to racism.
Right.
And of course, the men in her life who meant her no good. And all of these things sort of collided to alter the course of her life one night here in Philadelphia when she was performing. What happened?
Well, she was doing a show, and they'd been following her all week. And it was that they had been following Billy since 1939, and this was 1948 at this point, so almost a good decade. Mm-hmm. And the drug addiction had gotten worse. She was living in a hotel in New York, and the guy she was with was clearly out buying drugs for her every day. And she was being surveilled by at least the FBN, if not the FBN and the FBI. And so she did have drugs in her room, and so they saw this as and they'd been following her for a while now, so they saw this as an opportunity to sweep in and arrest her. And they almost did, but she got back to New York when she realized they were raiding the hotel where she was staying. And it was her manager who would end up, sort of turning on her, who convinced her to come back and to plead guilty, because they had busted the room and found the paraphernalia and the drugs. And so she comes back to Philly, and she appears in a court without a lawyer, because her manager said, "Oh, you don't need a lawyer." Mm. The manager, of course, was in cahoots with the authorities at the time, unbeknownst to Billy. And so she pleads guilty, but asks for the treatment.
Mm-hmm. She thinks she's going to get sent to a hospital.
She thinks she's going to go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And so she waives her right to an attorney. I describe all this in the book, mm-hmm. and it's in a whole sort of drawn out scene. And the judge, instead of sending her to a hospital, sends her to prison. And says, basically, you're a convicted criminal. You're being sentenced to a year and a day. And you're leaving the court right now and going to prison, which is what they did. They didn't even give her a chance to, she went through withdrawal on the train going down. And then the days, she was in withdrawal for, I think, 19 days. Mm. So they gave her one shot to put her on the train, and then she was on her own after that.
And she was there for the better part of that year.
Almost a whole year.
Yeah. You wrote about how the one thing in life that she wanted more than anything else was to be a mother.
Mm-hmm. Children.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's various reasons why. I mean, she was obviously sexually promiscuous when she was young. Who knows if she developed diseases that could have prevented her from, later on, mm-hmm. becoming pregnant. But she was never able to have a child. She tried to adopt, but after the mid-40s, with that arrest, they're not going to give an adopted child to someone with a criminal record. And so she was never able to adopt. But there was a consequence that happened as a result of all this. The people in her life who knew how much she wanted children would then, if they had a child, they would ask her to be the godmother. So she's the godmother to this whole long string of kids, of her friends, So this is their gesture to her, so that she could have some sort of connection with the children as they were growing up.
And there was a young lady that she identified and said, "Boy, if I had a daughter, mm-hmm. she would be just like you."
Yolanda Bavon, yeah.
Yeah.
She was in Paris, and this is October of 1958, and Billy was there to perform at the, she was on a tour that got aborted for a whole variety of reasons, which I detail in the book. So she ends up doing an impromptu residency at the Mars Club. And Yolande is across town, 16 years old, mind you, just young genius, performing at the Blue Note. And Billy sees her one night at a soul food restaurant in Paris called Gabby and Haynes. And she sends Mal Waldron over to the table and says, Billie Holiday would like for you to come sit with us. And Yolande was 16 from Sri Lanka. She was, no, I'll stay here. I'm friends with Yolande now, so I can talk
about tell the story.
Yeah. She's such a sweet woman. I love her to death. Yeah. So Mal goes back over, and then as they're leaving, Billie comes over and she goes, if I had a daughter, I want her to be just like you. Mm. And then she leaves. And so Yolande's playing the next night at the Blue Note, and she looks out, and who comes in but Billie Holiday. Mm. And she sits at the bar, and she listens to the set. And after the set, Yolande comes over and says, well, thank you for coming. I wish I was singing better tonight. She says, you need to work with me. You need to let me work with you. I can make you sing better. And so they end up having master classes. She taught Yolande how to sing certain of her songs, Solitude, Don't Explain. And in exchange, Yolande then had to spend time with her because Billie had this, I don't know if it was a fear or what, she just hated to be alone, which is why she put up with a lot of these men in her life, because they were there, So Yolande would go hang out with her in her hotel room and go with her until they had to go their separate ways to go to their different clubs. And then Billie would teach her how to sing songs.
Yeah. So many more questions I could ask you, but I'll ask you one more and then we'll open it up for our audience. And that is about the album Lady in Satin that you mentioned that was recorded near the end of her life. The stakes were really high with that album, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit about why that is unique in her work, maybe a little bit about the recording sessions and kind of how that album was received.
Well, I call it in my book, I call it a masterpiece because I think it is. Is it the best record that she recorded? No. Is her voice the best on this record? No. Probably Lady Sings the Blues, her voice is much better on that record, even though it was only, 2 years before. But the voice really went down a lot at the end. But there was a combination of the music, the musicians, the singer, the material. It was the first time that she had always wanted to sing with a full orchestra, like 30 strings. A big string section and 35 musicians, just a whole, Frank Sinatra got it all the time. Why didn't she get one? They had let her play with strings a couple of times. Loverman had some strings on it, but not a full Frank Sinatra type orchestra. And so she goes to Ray Ellis. She goes to Irving Townsend at Columbia. She hadn't recorded there in a long, long time. And she goes, I'll come back, but I want the full thing. I want a big orchestra. And I want Ray Ellis
from
to do
Philadelphia
the arrangements.
Also, right?
Huh?
He was also from Philadelphia, Ray Ellis.
Yes, he was.
Life. Yeah.
Another Philadelphia boy. And he was the up-and-coming arranger at the time. Mm-hmm. So she wanted him because she wanted those lush, beautiful arrangements like Sinatra had. Mm-hmm. She was basing it all on Sinatra, who, by the way, admits that everything he learned from Billie Holiday, from going to 52nd Street and studying her on 52nd Street. They were really close friends. And so Townsend goes, sure, Ray Ellis goes, great. Now, Billie was not in great shape at this point with her voice, but she made those songs so believable. She delivered those songs with such emotion and such believability. And then what happens is that beautiful, lush music just makes the pain in her voice so much more apparent. Mm. And you realize, oh my God, this is like her statement of life, And I've never grown tired of listening to that record. Yeah. You can just listen to it over and over and over again. It's funny, Ray Ellis thought it was a disaster. Mm. After the first recording session, he ran into the bathroom and threw up. He thought that his career was going to be over, and it had just gotten started, because he was young and up and coming. And then the record came out, and the reviews were mixed too, which was unusual for Billie because all of her records usually got very well received. There were some people said, boy, this is a bad idea. Who let her in the studio to record this? Mm. And then there were people like me who went, this is the best record she's done.
Yeah.
And then over time, it just became clear what a phenomenal piece of work it was. And so finally, by the end of his life, one of the things that Ray Ellis was known for was recording that record.
Yeah.
And he recorded the next record with her too, but she had really lost steam by that point. This is in about 6 months before she died. So that record is not as great as Lady in Satin.
Yeah. Paul does go on to describe, you know, her last days of life, and interestingly uses the last year of her life as sort of a launching pad to flash back to other parts of her life. So you really get the whole of her life in this book. Highly recommend. There's so much more we could talk about, but let's open it up for your questions for Paul.
Anything? You said before as to the fact that Billie Holiday would exaggerate a lot. Do you think that had anything to do with her childhood? Because a lot of times if you have a certain type of childhood, you will want to exaggerate and literally make it seem better than what it was.
You know, it's that you could be onto something there. The strangest moment when I was doing research for this book I found of her exaggerating, she did it all the time. And, you know, Lady Sings the Blues, the book, which was her autobiography, came out in 1956. I would say about half of it is just completely made up. But then when Tallulah Bankhead did her autobiography in early the 1950s, half of hers was made up too. So it was just a thing they did. But the weirdest example, when she was being checked into the prison in 1948, and they were doing the intake interview, she was just making up stories about her life then too. But it all had to do with creating this happy family with a happy set of parents and a happy child. And they moved from Baltimore to Harlem because, you know, he could get more work there because he was a musician. And it was like her version of a white picket fence childhood. Yeah. None of it was true. And she's telling that to a prison officer who's writing it all down and then typing it all up. And that was their take on Billie Holiday's background. So there may have been something. But she also just loved to entertain audiences. And she would, you know, she wanted a good story. She didn't really care about the facts. If it was a good story, she told it. It's hard to tell. I think the interesting story is that she made up the story. I think it's endearing that she would do this. I don't have a problem with it at all. The odd thing is the possession of strange fruit, because if you buy Lady Sings the Blues, even today it says in the book that she wrote the music, and she didn't.
Never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
No, right? Not in the way of a good story.
I wonder if she ever had to go in front of the McCarthy trials for her relationship with communism.
She did not. She worked with people who did, but she herself did not ever appear before the committee. People close to her, around her, did at the time, though. So she knew exactly what was going on with all that. And I'm not entirely sure why they didn't call her, because she did an interview in the mid-40s with PM magazine in which she said she was a communist. So it's on record, you know. Now, she did say that she was identifying with the Communist Party because of their stand on racial issues, not necessarily other things. But she did say it.
How did she know?
In the brothels in Baltimore, where she was, there were two in particular. The first one was just sort of a place where she landed to get away from the home life, which was very chaotic. But the second one, they let her start singing. And so she had been listening to the gramophone. She had heard particularly early Louis Armstrong records that she liked and Bessie Smith records that she liked. So I think that's where she got the sense that I could do this. And then the second brothel, they let her sing. So while while the guys were sitting around in the room and the girls were doing whatever, she would be the entertainment. So she would be singing. And I think that...
Just
She had a great voice. No training ever. She could not read or write music. But she wrote 15 songs, five of which are classics. I mean, think about that for a while. And she recorded over 300 songs in, you know, her catalog. But there were she just connected with the jazz vibe, and she knew right away that she could entertain audiences. So in that second brothel, before you knew it, she was appearing at little venues nearby, like a theater or an after-hours club. And then she developed a following. She had a little following down there, people that would go around and see her at these places. And she just had a sense that she could do this. So that's why she ended up going to New York. Well, her mother summoned her to New York because she was hanging out in the brothels. And then, of course, they end up in a brothel in New York, the both of them working together in Harlem as soon as she got up here. That was the last time they did that. Billy was busted and put in jail for a period of time. I think it was 100 days. And it was long enough to get her attention. And so they both left that after that. It was after that that her mother went back to the domestic work. And Billy got serious about being a song, you know, a singer. And she paired up with a guy down in Brooklyn. And they started playing in the clubs in Brooklyn and Queens before she ends up in Harlem. And once she hits Harlem, that she starts on the ascent and she never looked back.
You know, Paul, she's often described as a blues singer.
She's not a blues singer.
But yeah, can you talk about that? Because oftentimes people describe her that way, but I don't think that's how she saw herself.
No, she did not identify with being a blues singer. Oddly enough, she didn't really identify with being a jazz singer either. So what she would call herself is a song stylist. Mm-hmm. You know, and obviously she's a jazz singer, and she's the, in my opinion, she's the greatest jazz singer to come out of jazz. But she was not a blues singer. She only recorded 8 or 10 blues records. Mm-hmm. Ironically enough, she wrote two of them herself. She knew how to write the blues. Mm-hmm. But she could have sung the blues. She knew how to sing the blues. She was making a choice not to sing the blues, which is why I call her a jazz singer.
And you know, you write too about how her critics, both in life and in death, felt compelled to take shots at her. And it's so interesting, like, to read some of the quotes that you have from some of her critics.
Time magazine is the worst.
Yeah, who talked about her face, her weight, her drug issues, not too much about her actual talent.
Right, Time was horrible. They said she doesn't care enough about how she looks to go on a diet, or some, you know, paraphrase.
Yeah.
It was a way to belittle her and marginalize her. So, you know, that article, I think, was the one about Strange Fruit. So they're trying to really, you know, knock her down a peg or two. Yeah. And so by focusing on, you know, her weight early on or the drug problems later on, it's a way to marginalize her, to undercut the achievement that she was actually making as an artist. I mean, she viewed herself as an artist. That's why she liked to go to Europe, because they described her as she was an artist. She was a vocal artist to them. Over here, it was a whole different way to describe her and to talk about her, and she was offended by that a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But she viewed herself as an artist, a singing artist.
Yeah.
Which is what I try to portray her as in the book.
And you write about how, you know, toward the end of her life, I mean, throughout the book there is this thread of her being ill, right?
Yeah.
And you begin to sort of see, you know, she's losing weight and friends are becoming concerned.
Frantic.
And, yeah. And so by the late 50s, it's clear to the people around her that she is not well. But she ignored, you know, these diagnoses. Someone told her she had cirrhosis. She
a friend of hers
that
was a doctor.
Was a doctor, right.
He said, "This is one of the worst cases I've ever seen. Let me take you to an emergency room. I can't practice here in New York, but I'll drive you somewhere."
Yeah. And she refused until she had no choice and ended up in the hospital.
She collapsed in her kitchen and as it turned out, went into a coma. And it was only then that the people around her were able to get her to a hospital.
Yeah.
And then, sadly enough, she never got out of the hospital.
Yeah. And even then, law enforcement was pursuing her.
Well, the moment she got settled into her her bed. This is in like the first week. For the first several days, she was unconscious, you know, but she finally did come out of it. And so she was talking to Maylee Dufty, who was one of her good friends. William Dufty had co-written Lady Sings the Blues with her. And she said, "You just watch, they're going to arrest me in this bed." Mm-hmm. And then before you knew it, they arrested her in that bed. Yeah. She knew it was coming because they had been pursuing her for 2 decades. Every time she turned around, they would, I interviewed Jack Gilford's widow, who was the MC at Cafe Society. He said they routinely, when he and Billy would leave work, you know, at 4 a.m., there would be people, you know, law enforcement, you know, FBI, FBN, somebody was there watching them. They were watching them all the time.
Well, sometimes they'd come to the club and request songs.
Well, that's what they did in San Francisco after Colonel White busted her in her hotel room because evidence had been planted mm-hmm. in the hotel room, which was determined later in the trial where they found her not guilty.
And this was a different case from the one in Philly that we talked about.
This is a San Francisco case. Yeah. This is a whole different one. Colonel White shows up the day after he arrested her, booked her, the whole thing. He shows up the next night at the club where she's playing and makes requests from the front row.
Yeah.
If that's not intimidation, I don't know what is. That's when you're trying to tear somebody down, which is what they did with her for 20 years.
Yeah. I have one. What's your favorite Billie Holiday song?
Oh, Lord. Well, I could listen to the whole Lady in Satin album over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. But I've had to go off that probably, and I think your father played on the original, Good Morning Heartache. Mm. It's hard to beat that song.
Yeah.
So you thank your father for that.
Classic tune. Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Paul Alexander for a wonderful conversation and a wonderful book.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.